Search your killer. Wonderful, isn't it? Pheromone signature left by his body. These are scent molecules. 10 years ago, one of his kind stalked and eliminated an elite special forces crew in Central America. There were two survivors. They indicated that when trapped, the creature activated a self-destruct device that destroyed enough rainforest to cover 300 city blocks. Remarkable weaponry. That's right, Lieutenant. Otherworld life forms.
Huh?
A fucking alien. Iwo Jima, Cambodia, Beirut, drawn by heat and conflict. He's on safari. Lions, the tigers, the bears. Oh my.
Welcome to the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast. Look at the Predator film series. Join Garrett.
We are a rescue team, not assassins.
Adam.
You son of a bitch.
And Matt.
How'd you snag a ticket on this shitmobile?
As they get themselves to the analysis chopper and review each Predator film not yet covered here at Percolated Media.
So why don't you use the regular army? What do you need us for?
Because some damn fool accused you of being the best.
If you would like to hear the co-host views on the Alien vs. Predator films and Prey, check out our Percolated Media archives as the films were reviewed back in 2022.
This is getting better by the minute.
So stick around, podcast listeners.
Guess who's back?
The Percolated Media Predator Retrospective begins now.
Grab a seat. Enjoy the show. This is history.
Predator. Released June 12th, 1987. Budget was $18 million. Box office, $98.3 million. And this is directed by John McTiernan. All right, Matt. Well, we did Prey a few years ago when we launched the site. And we know there's another Predator movie coming out this year. In fact, there was one that was released earlier this year, which we're going to get to. Matt, why did you want to do this series? Do you just want to start from the beginning here?
Completionism being one thing, but not only do we have one new movie that's already out, we're having a second, which for all intents and purposes is a sequel to a movie that one of the first things we covered on the site was Prey. So it kind of made sense to redo this series, but we'll be covering just as many new entries as we did in the original incarnation building up to the 2018 movie. You know, there were three existing ones at that time because we intentionally avoided AVP leading up to a new one. And now we have, with Prey and the two new ones, enough runway to redo this series. So I think this was a justified retooling. You know, this is our own version of rebooting.
It's all right. And we're probably going to cover a lot of the same things that we talked about in those original shows, because I'll go ahead and say again, as much as I enjoy Predator, I've always been more of an Alien guy. My best friend of 30 years, however, has always been more of a Predator guy. So Adam, I want to go to you as somebody who had a cardboard standee of Predator in his room when I knew you. How much does Predator mean to you, sir?
This character has just always been kind of like the badassery of movie characters, of alien type characters, of Stan Winston at his absolute best. I had a Predator cutout, but I also, when I was growing up, you're talking like 10, 11, 12 years old, I had a life-size, no, I must have been 12, because it was a Predator 2 life-size poster that covered my door. So my entire bedroom door was a fucking Predator 2 poster. So there was just something always cool about this guy, about this thing, you know? I mean, it was growing up that time, this was just one of those characters. Though I've always said, man, it's amazing how much, think about another franchise that we've discussed recently, how much one good movie can carry just an iconic look, an iconic character. And that's forever what we had with Predator. And yeah, this guy was just, he was just a badassery thing to me. You know, as well as this movie with everything that's in it, this was just machismo to the max, all the way down to the villain, antagonist or protagonist, depending on how you want to look at it.
Yep. The two of us grew up with this character. I watched this movie so much as a kid. I had a video cassette of it. I wore it out. It was just something I grew up with. And then the second one came out. I saw it in theaters, and we'll talk about that next week. But yeah, this character, for me, again, as much as I enjoy it, I didn't like it as much as Alien. God, did I sure love it. Now, Matt, as we always come to when we get to these 80s series, Adam and I grew up with this character. You didn't. You came to it later after it was already out a set of years. What is your experience with Predator, sir?
Mostly with like extra media beyond the first movie. There were some video games that was at the time popular. AVP, for as bad as those movies are, at least in our opinion, and the opinions of many, were important in sort of getting people my age, because it was PG-13 and I was 11 when that came out. So I realized what this franchise was. But my nostalgia for it is tied to Schwarzenegger more than anything else, because this is sort of not quite his height, but he was on the incline, because we've already talked about this came out the same year as The Running Man, and he had already done Conan and Terminator, among others. So like, this is sort of him about to become the movie star of that time frame. And it came from a director who's no stranger to these type of big, you know, well-regarded action films. So again, two movies in 87 that star Schwarzenegger and Jesse Ventura. That's the funniest thing too.
And we covered Lethal Weapon earlier this year. Like, you want all of the 1987 action to go on this site. So we just got through talking about Jaws, and I gotta say, we talked about the tough production history of that movie. I had no idea until I started doing research for this podcast. This had almost as bad a fucking production history. They hired Arnold Schwarzenegger, obviously. He enjoyed the script, but they needed a director, so they went to Jeff Murphy. Now, anyone who doesn't know who Jeff Murphy was, he was a director who worked on Young Guns 2. He did Free Jack.
Free Jack.
Yeah, does a lot of pulp, but apparently him and Schwarzenegger did not get along. And so when you don't get along with Schwarzenegger, you're going to be off the project. And there's a lot of back and forth about the production of this, in that people can't get their story straight. Some people say that Joel Silver was the one who recommended John McTiernan. Some people say it was Lawrence Gordon. Some people say it was Arnold himself. But after one movie that is awful, by the way, I watched Nomad for the first time leading up to this particular podcast, and I don't know what they saw in that movie with Pierce Brosnan that got them to hire John McTiernan for this, but he was right on board. Matt, have you seen Nomads?
Yeah, but it's the same internal foresight. It must be the same mind reader that saw Piranha 2 and thought James Cameron would be great for Terminator.
It's a boring as hell movie, which, by the way, it is the only script that McTiernan ever wrote, and I think that's telling. So they brought the director on board. Now, they didn't know whether to get Carl Weathers, because Carl Weathers was somebody, he was coming off Rocky, his asking price was pretty high, but it was McTiernan who convinced him to bring Weathers on board, and then they brought the rest of the people on, including Shane Black, who we spoke about earlier this year, and this is a funny story. So they originally thought they were going to bring Shane Black on because he, of course, had written Lethal Weapon. Joel Silver is a producer of this as well. And they thought that they were going to get some rewrites out of Shane Black, some free rewrites. But Shane Black said, I don't want to do that. I just want to act in this movie. So as a consolation prize, guess what? They killed him off. He was the first one killed off. Matt, had you heard that story?
I've heard that story because he also has talked about how much fun he had on this project, but he was worried that they weren't going to pay him to do the writing. So this is how you get around it. You put him in the movie. But it's also crazy, you know, same year as Lethal Weapon.
Yep.
You talk about fast rise. I mean, they don't get much quicker than that for a guy who was, what, 25?
Yeah. Yeah. Wonderkin. Adam, you'd heard that story, right?
Yeah, I have. And I believe he does do some, at minimum, some touch-ups. But it was one of the things that almost everybody that they populated with was kind of expected to do a little bit of double duty. You know, either some on-set advice or, you know, just that kind of work. And he was like, look, if something goes wrong, I need somebody here that could do this. So imagine if you got to keep this budget tight, especially when you have a major change after you've already started filming, which we'll discuss. Hey, it worked out.
Let's talk about the writers of this. Jim and John Thomas. These guys, I want to say right now, this is probably going to be in my recap of this entire film, but I think this is a case of a mediocre script getting turned into a classic, much like we talked about when we talked about the first Mission Impossible film, in that Brian De Palma came in, took a script that was thrown together, as we talked about on that podcast, and made a pretty enjoyable film out of it. This is considered a masterpiece, and I don't think it would have been if not for this director, because these two guys, they would go on to write next week's film. We'll talk about it. They also did Executive Decision, okay, fun enough film that me and Adam saw in theaters. And they also worked on Wild Wild West, which is, well, a movie I still haven't seen, but its reputation speaks for itself. So, I don't know. Matt, these writers, they kind of panned gold, didn't they?
Yeah, well, it's a very similar situation to use another screenwriting example. Have you looked at the writers who did Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
No.
Mm-mm.
All right. So the reason I bring this up is if when you watch that movie, you're like, wow, this is a really good script. What else have these guys done? And you look at their track record, they wrote Doc Holliday, Wild Wild West, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, Shrek 3, Last Holiday. You're like, where did this come from? So it's kind of one of those situations where it's just they lucked into success and just couldn't, I don't want to say one and done, but pretty close.
All right, so there's the writers. Now, let's talk about the lead villain of this film and the casting of it, which is quite a story. So they get these big dudes, right? These guys who are like 6'3", 6'4", 6'5", and all of them have huge bodybuilding regimens, and I mean, they are all big as hell. So who do you cast as your villain? Well, somebody by the name of Jean-Claude Van Damme was roaming around the 20th Century Fox Studios, aching for the casting director to cast him in something. So she finally caved and put 5'9 Jean-Claude Van Damme in this film. Couple things here. One, the original makeup design for this, if people go and they Google it, it was awful. It looked like a duck.
It was like a glorified praying mantis.
It was so bad. So you have that. Plus, you put that costume on 5'9 Jean-Claude Van Damme, and you look at these guys, and even Bill Duke can look at him and say, dude, I dwarf you. It was not formidable at all.
It's such a bad... And also, they couldn't color it green or blue because you can't match the forest or the sky. So they went with like a dark red, and it just would have looked like this giant eyesore. Although giant's a bit of a stretch because I don't know if Jean-Claude Van Damme was tall enough to reach where the camera mount was. But I think this is one of those instances where things actually turned out for the better.
Yeah. And we're going to get to who eventually designed this in a bit. But Adam, have you seen those designs? Have you heard anything about Jean-Claude Van Damme in this role?
Yeah, I have. And I think he was on set for all of like 3 days. And what a fucking prima donna, fresh off the boat from Brussels, and he starts bitching and moaning as soon as he's like the first thing that he's in. It's amazing how serendipitous things work. The original design, it definitely didn't work for this. I feel like it almost looks like a proto version of Samael from Hellboy, the 2004 movie, just in the like it's the way that it's very head forward. But thank God it got changed. And just imagine, like, you went into production with this thing. And it wasn't until you were mid-filming before you had to completely scrap it. And I love that Arnold, this is why you can't, people that have connections, goes to his buddy Stan Winston, is like, I need a monster. And I love that the story, I'm sorry, I know you get into it, but Stan Winston had this conversation with James Cameron and had seen this picture of like this Rastafarian warrior. And James Cameron's like, ooh, I like mandibles. And fucking voila, we get one of the best creature designs in movie history.
Well, yeah, it's half of what makes this character work. But I still want to get to Van Damme because he gets on the set and I don't know what script he read where he thought that he wasn't going to be in costume the entire fucking time, but he thought it was going to be him versus Arnold. People were going to come to see that. He had no idea he was going to be covered in this costume. And you talk to 10 guys involved in this production, all 10 will have a different version of why Van Damme was off this production. Some say he quit. Some say he threw the mask down, broke a $10,000 mask, and was fired on the spot by Silver. There are so many stories out there as to why Van Damme isn't on this production, but I agree with both you guys where it was serendipitous. But here's the thing. With that happening, McTiernan had to do the Spielberg, where he had to work around it. So that is a lot of the reasons why we get a lot of the scenes of this team in action is because he had to film something. And let's also not forget, they're not on some soundstage. They're not being dressed by these leaves around them. They are in an actual jungle. So, and every single step they take is at an angle. And I don't know how McTiernan was able to make running scenes in this particular jungle, but it's just one part of why this movie is so well regarded is because of how well it's made, how well it's shot. Adam, could you imagine doing this on unlevel ground?
Can't. And mad props to John McTiernan, who is a new director. And maybe it's that because it's his first full-length motion picture for a studio. And just the balls that go with that. I don't know. I think maybe Van Damme was fired for snorting up half a Joel Silver stash, you know, maybe in an afternoon between takes. This movie should not work. It really, really shouldn't. And it's kind of astounding that it works as well as it does. And is, I'll say it, the classic that it is, that it still stands out that way.
Well, it's also amazing that when you shoot in the jungle or any sort of, you know, predominantly outdoor environment that's not next to a soundstage, it can go horribly wrong because everything is against you. The elements, it's very easy for your production schedule to get delayed because you're kind of at the mercy of what's around you. And you've got people that aren't exactly the most, I don't want to call it, they're not jerks, but I can't imagine a guy like Schwarzenegger or Jesse Ventura just enjoying sitting there doing nothing, waiting for a storm to pass or whatever. So everything that's here had the makings to be just a, even at best, a B movie that nobody really cared about. But when you got a guy at the helm who would prove his mettle, not just with this, as we'll talk about, but afterwards, it's one of the great surprise successes, certainly in Arnold's career, because, you know, this movie, much like Terminator, was based on an original IP, involves James Cameron, ironically, and has that, you know, sci-fi action horror mix that I think it works so well. Because this movie, yeah, it's one thing, depending on your perspective, but it's also a lot of different things that works to its advantage.
One of those things that works to its advantage is who they eventually cast. And before they went to Stan Winston, which, Adam, thank you for jumping that far ahead. they actually went to Rick Baker, and he said, look, I can't come to that production. I'm busy with something else. But I have somebody I just worked with by the name of Kevin Peter Hall, who I just did work on Harry and the Hendersons. I think he would do it. They asked him to come in. This guy apparently was a joy to work with. He died at the age of 34 because of a blood transfusion he had that gave him AIDS on the set of Harry and the Hendersons. Just tragic end. But he's on this production, and he's interviewed on these special features, which I watched for this particular podcast, and couldn't be more humble. And he's even saying, look, I'm not the star of this. I don't even know if anything I'm doing here is going to work. Like, he had hand gestures in this. He had things that he did that he wanted to make the character into its own thing. But guess what? People have been trying to ape that for decades. Adam, what do you think about the casting of Kevin Peter Hall here?
I think he's almost as important as anybody else. Yes, obviously the makeup, the prosthetic, and all that is a huge part of the Predator character. But what he does in bringing it to life, the way he moves, his mannerisms, is as important as anything else. And that he does those mannerisms against some of these other people, especially Arnold Schwarzenegger and Carl Weathers, where you actually get them like face to face. Kevin Peter Hall is as important as almost anything. And I love when you watch the behind the scenes documentary. I rewatched If It Bleeds, We Can Kill It, that documentary. Find it on YouTube, all stitched together. He loved being in this production. And I think it kind of helps to stitch it all together as good as it does.
My favorite type of actor is one who is completely humble while doing something extraordinary. That's how those interviews come off.
Matt, Nick, couldn't it be easy? You know, you're coming in after the other guy's already gone. You're getting this new prosthetic kit, and you are in the jungle. You're in the heat. You're being filmed probably only seconds at a time, because imagine lighting this thing. Mm-hmm. God, no wonder the cinematographer went on to work with Baz Luhrmann, because that had to be easier than this bullshit. So kudos to Mr. Hall.
Well, it's also important because you take a job where nobody's going to know who you are. They're not going to see your face. You're not going to have any lines. So you're kind of doing it out of a certain degree of humility, although I hope he was well compensated. But he is one of the pieces that of the Predator puzzle, along with the design and the sound work they come up with, the thought they put into the weapons. Like, it all comes together. This is not a one aspect carrying everything else type of creature. It's all like a harmonious piece working cohesively.
All right. With that, let's get right in, boys. Although, you know what? I watched this movie so much over the years, I didn't have to watch it for this podcast. I could have done this plot summary without it. But I did watch it, and I took notes. Here we go. We open with a spaceship flying by. And I want to ask right off the bat, was this a good idea to show that we're dealing with an alien in the opening scene?
Not necessary. And I think if you were to ask most people, do you ever see a spaceship in this film? They would say no. Because this is such a quick pre-title thing. Half the time, I forget that this even exists. So I'm okay with it. I don't think it's necessary, but I'm perfectly fine with it. I'd rather it here than to have it show up at the end.
We then see the arrival of commandos to a base. We have Arnold Schwarzenegger, we have Jesse Ventura, we have Shane Black, Sonny Landham, Richard Chavez, and Bill Duke. Now, Landham I knew from 48 Hours. This is about as testosterone-filled as you can get, isn't it?
Oh my goodness. You could just feel the HGH pumping on screen as literally Commando decides to land a chopper here. If you watch behind the scenes, you watch interviews, it's amazing how much they tease each, and they're all kind of smiling. But you got to remember, this is Mr. Olympia, and this is the former world champion, you know, with Jesse. And this is the dude that went toe-to-toe with Sylvester Stallone, who had its own rivalry going on with Arnold Schwarzenegger. So you got so much in here, and the jokes that they would play on each other, that neither one of them wanted to watch each other work out, that they tried to do it in secret and act like they weren't working out. This shit's great. And it's heightened by me that Arnold Schwarzenegger pulls off a Tiger Woods and decides to wear like a red shirt walking through the jungle in this freaking secret area. This is my chismo turned up to 11.
And what's funny about it too is this is about as economic characterizations as you can get, because you have Jesse Ventura coming out in an MTV shirt. You have Bill Duke coming out, by the way, with a shaver, which I never noticed. Like, they set that shaver up here in the opening scene, but he's coming out in a full suit. And of course you have Arnold with a cigar in tow. Just about as economic as you can get, right?
Oh yeah, there's so much masculinity in the air that I half expected, you know, the State Athletic Commission to try this movie for alleged steroid use.
John Thomas did say that he felt there was so much weightlifting on this set that he thinks Manly Man was coined off this particular set. Also in this scene, we get Alan Silvestri's only other great theme other than Back to the Future. And this score, it is uncanny how great it is and how wonderful it sets up exactly what we're going to be getting.
Yes, but I would fight you on his other scores, because I really like his score for The Abyss.
Oh, I forgot he did that. That's right. That was when him and James Horner were at odds. That's right.
And he did the Avengers theme.
Yeah, but that's a terrible
song. Oh, come on.
I'm about to slap you for knocking the Avengers theme. I think this is... It's phenomenal all the way through, and that we can all actually agree on a score might be as amazing and a freaking thing as this film itself. But no, Silvestri, I mean, from this, Avengers, he's one of those composers that he's been around for decades. He's no John Williams. He will never be John Williams, but he is so consistent in everything he's done all the way through. I mean, Polar Express, for such a weird ass movie, he's got a really good score that goes all the way through. Back to the Future is classic. So he's got those few classic pieces, and he's a workhorse. But this is one that you would put on his mantle.
They arrive at dawn. Okay. And we see that the general says that they need Arnold and his team to rescue a set of soldiers who strayed off course, and they're certainly in guerrilla hands. And this is when we meet Dylan, who shows up saying that he said Arnold and his team were the best, which is why they're here. And we get this really weird but famous mid-air arm wrestling match that anyone our age has imitated at least once.
Over and over again. But it's amazing that the plot set up for this is First Blood Part 2.
Like, yeah, it's a rescue mission.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh my, this is like the manliest handshake you will ever see in a movie. But I also like the dichotomy of having this brick shit house working for the CIA.
Right.
Like, you know, because he even says, like, you know, the CIA got you pushing too many pencils now. Like, because you think this guy is just going to send them off on the mission, not necessarily go with them.
Yeah, doesn't that, and I know we make this comparison a lot, especially this year, but doesn't that make him the Paul Reiser type character?
To an extent, in that there's more going on than they're led to believe, but I also think that this movie works in so many different ways, and one of the important aspects is the movie, in a lot of ways, it is every bit as bombastic and excessive as the movies he was making being Arnold before that. We'll talk about the big set piece shortly, but it leads you to believe that you're just watching Commando 2.0, just with a larger with a larger team. And also, if like if you're looking at this as a slasher movie, which you certainly can, unlike a bunch of helpless teenagers, there's something fascinating about watching like the best of the best get picked off one by one.
I love just the way this is done, and it's with very minimal dialogue. You know there's a past between these two. They know each other, and that builds throughout the rest of the course of this film, and it's so economic.
Yeah, I definitely have things to say about that horror aspect when we get to it. So Dylan and Dutch, they start talking about the good old days, and Dutch says that they're a rescue team, not assassins. Dylan then says that he's going with them, and the general says that despite Dutch's protests, they have their orders.
Which is also a line from, I think Schwarzenegger says that in Red Heat. Have my orders.
We then get Mustang Sally blasting from the speakers as Jesse Ventura is telling Poncho how many slack-jawed F-words are roaming around.
And I still can't believe that.
I can't either. And then we have Shane Black telling Billy off-color jokes, and Dutch is saying how much better this operation is, getting by the minute. I have to say, I think this every day at my work. But again, we have character development, I guess.
You have, in the span of like 30 seconds here, you identify each character, you give them a personality, and you distinguish them from one another. And that is other than just them looking different. And that's freaking amazing. Like, it is great. I love that they each bring something different to the role that they do. And it's funny. So I learned this Sergeant Rock comic that you see throughout the course of this film, it's because Arnold was trying to get Sergeant Rock made. Mm-hmm. And it's funny that, what are we, 38 years later, we're still trying to get that movie made. So he's the one that brought those comics on set that we see Shane Black reading throughout.
Which is also funny, because I always thought Shane Black would have been a good choice to direct a Sergeant Rock movie.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also funny that, like, one of the things that I always appreciate this movie, it does the aliens thing of you learn about these people through their actions, and everyone has a specific job. Like, you got one guy who's good with explosives, you got one guy who's the tracker. And my question is, what is Shane Black's job exactly? You know, because it's like one of these things are not like the other. Even Poncho, who's not built like Schwarzenegger or Ventura, but he's still in good shape. It's just like, why is Hawkins here? Other than to be like, he's like Robin, where we're going to dress him in a bright outfit and use him as a diversion.
Dylan tells Blaine that his tobacco chewing is a nasty habit, and I have to say I agree with him. Just a very good mood-setting scene here of seeing these guys just in their element. They jump down into position, and what a job McTiernan and his DP did of shooting this jungle to make us feel like we're right in it. Again, I'm going to be complimenting this direction a lot, and I know I already have, but my God, just the fact that every time I watch this movie, I just feel like I'm in the jungle. I smell the jungle when I watch this movie.
Oh, this movie will make you sweat.
Yes.
One of the things, like, I've always, you know, Commando, First Blood, any of the Rambo movies, well, except for 3, because that's desert. And this used to be kind of my take for jungle movies. After Tropic Thunder, I started really thinking about how horrible it had to shoot in these conditions.
Boy, Jurassic World sure could have used this kind of characterization, couldn't it?
Well, at least they went to Hawaii.
Yeah. We're getting some animal noises and Silvestri's music in the background. And of course, Arnold saying it's time to move. What I love is they set up the Predator ship earlier, so we know it's out there. But if you're watching this for the first time, it kind of leaves your mind as this stuff is going on.
I'm watching this for probably the 20 to 25th time, and it still leaves my mind.
Yeah.
Like, because it's almost like an asteroid floating through space before that title comes up. So you just don't even think about it.
So Dutch is getting word that it's not looking like a normal army taxi, and it seems like a surveillance job. So Dutch is really questioning Dylan on how much they were prepared for what they're walking into. We're seeing Billy cut a branch and drink the fluid from it, and he notices noises behind them, which includes a dinosaur-type sound effect. He follows the noises to a set of skinned alive bodies hanging upside down. What a reveal this is.
Oh, me Uncle Frank. Okay, as I'm taking notes, we'll do Hellraiser someday, people. The only thing that was weird about this, I think this is the only time we actually see victims skinned. You know, we see so much of other things that it does, and it almost makes you wonder, did the Predator actually do this? But these people are skinned, and that's not something that our creature does.
I think it was originally supposed to until EVP got involved.
Yeah, it's a hell of a reveal. We're only like 20 minutes into the film. We've introduced everybody. We get in our placement for the rest of the movie. We find the choppa. We see what's going on. And this is gory as all hell.
I also like that the movie throws this at you right away, because outside of the opening, you have no reason to believe that aliens are involved. Like, they could just be going to, it might as well be the Viet Cong for all we know.
Mm-hmm.
So to see something this shocking and graphic, all things considered, is, you know, you could look at that as just psychological warfare on the enemy's part. But I like that there right away you can tell there's more to this than they were led to believe. So you kind of learn and unwrap everything with the characters until they get the curveball of, oh, there's something else that neither of us were aware of.
So Dutch grabs some tags and notices it's somebody he knew, saying that he knew these men. And Dylan reinforces that no one told him there was an operation in this area. Mac is questioning Blaine on what's going on, and Billy says that they seem to have been in a firefight, but he can't spot any tracks. It just seems like they disappeared. Dutch says that they need to stay on mission and get the hostages. Blaine takes out his huge minigun that he calls Old Painless, and my God, this fucking gun. Oh, I loved this as a kid. I would get squirt guns that were machine guns and pretend that they were this particular gun. Like, I loved Old Painless.
This is so badass. And this just seems like one of those things to try to one-up your co-star. You know, we see Arnold Schwarzenegger with like the machine guns and stuff like that. So, of course, Jesse Ventura is going to have a freaking, just have this Gatling gun pulled right off the side of a helicopter. This is badass. And the sound it makes, the sound design, it's, oh God, this is great.
The sound design in this movie is impeccable.
Yeah. And even the Predator isn't the only one who gets badass weapons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny too, because they can only film this thing like 5 seconds at a time. So you're seeing all of this put together. And again, that's the magic of direction and editing. And this is also when we see the infrared predator vision for the first time. And I love how McTiernan is kind of unveiling this creature little by little. Again, if you're going to the movies in 1987 and only had seen the poster of Arnold holding his gun in the jungle, you'd have no idea what's coming. And of course,
also it abides by the classic monster rule of you wait to show your monster, but you can tease it.
Very Spielberg-like in that first Jaws movie is what I thought of.
Yeah, and it unveils just a little bit about its technology and what you learn about it as you go. So you learn about the creature before you ever see it.
We're seeing that the creature is just kind of observing these commandos as they go about their mission, and we cut to them moving around the jungle, again, as the Predator keeps his eye on them, and Mac warns Dylan that if he gives up their positions, he'll quote-unquote bleed him. Dutch gets in a bear crawl, and they see the operation that they were sent to stop, and then we're seeing hostages getting shot, so they get in position, and here's a question I have for you guys. With the exception of the fact that we're in an action movie and we haven't had any action yet, what is the storyline reason this rescue scene is here?
Like, why is it here in the context of the story?
It's just funny. Like, this is a gratuitous action scene that material.
Oh, okay. So this is also a purposeful misdirect, because it leads you to believe the whole movie is going to be this. And I think it was smart. The only thing that it's a positive and a negative, Arnold's one-liners are here, you know, stick around or knock, knock, you know, because he blasts the guy through the door. They're here, so it leads you to think, oh, this is just another Arnold. This might as well be a sequel to Commando, but you could have called it Commandos, like Alien to Aliens, given this team. But that stuff slowly dissipates as the movie progresses. So I like that, much like the Predator, the movie actually like evolves. And I don't want to say gets smarter, but it's certainly more cerebral than anything not named Terminator that Schwarzenegger was making. But I also love how it is glorious excess. Like, the bombs going off, you got people falling, you got people lighting themselves on fire, you got people falling while they're on fire, and apparently this was the team that worked on the A-Team.
Yeah, so they're falling off the towers in slow motion, which was...
Yeah, they fall off the towers, and the, you know, they land on pads, but that doesn't mean, like, it's cartoony, but the movie also has a strong sense of knowing when to insert the more graphic stuff. Like, you watch someone just get nonchalantly shot in the head through binoculars. you see, you know, people get shot in this, and it's not quite Verhoeven, but the blood is rampant. So I think this is well executed for what it is, and they basically blew almost their entire budget on this 5-10 minute sequence.
It was only 2 years removed from Rambo, First Blood Part 2, which is a jungle rescue mission, and Commando, which also has Bill Duke in it, let's not forget, which is a... I mean, you might as well have Alyssa Milano show up here in this.
Oh, she should have been the woman they rescued.
She definitely should have been Anna.
Yeah. I mean, so, which is funny, because in that one you have, what's her name, Cindy Ray Dong Chong show up, which is almost you get in this one. So I do, to Matt's point, it is a great misdirect, because we've seen this, and we enjoyed it in two movies only 2 years ago, and this is almost exactly like that, to that excess where we blow shit up real good. I mean, it's one of the things that at least America is actually good at. We blow shit up good, and so we put them in here and we do it, and this is glorious excess, and it is filmed within an inch of its life. It's great. And then the movie turns.
Are you also going to mention the Ventura line?
I ain't got time to bleed.
Yeah, because that line is... The movie makes you, because this movie is also kind of a critique of like masculinity, because everyone's like, that line is so badass, but they forget the way Pancho reacts to it, where he's just like, oh,
you.
It's almost like he realizes how stupid that is.
Yeah, because he's like, you have time to duck?
I actually wrote that one down because everybody knows Ain't Got Time to Bleed, but yeah. The response to it is just as good. And I like that they brought Jesse, and I feel, okay, Jesse Ventura was not a Navy SEAL, people. He was a frogman. He did demo. Mm-hmm. But when he's crawling through and there's little things, like he comes across the Claymore tripwire, there's no doubt that's Jesse talking about, this is the shit we went through. And I feel like he has just a level of authenticity, but just heightened with his wrestling persona that captivates so well.
Well, why don't you tell me why I was a Navy SEAL?
I feel this is here for a couple reasons. One, I think it's here so that they can release this movie as an action movie. I think if the scene wasn't here, you couldn't legitimately call it an action movie. You could just call it a science fiction horror film. And two, mm-hmm. I think this is here to establish that these guys are formidable, so that when we do see the Predator take them out one by one later, we kind of feel for them because we see how good they are, and the Predator is that good, if not better.
And you're selling this to our parents at the time, so yep. Vietnam was still fresh. Iran-Contra and all that kind of stuff going down in South America was news at the time. So this is, it's what we were doing. It's Ollie North.
So the team moves in and they start taking out some guards as Dutch casually lifts a car and sends it into some more guards. We see old Painless in action, and I love Blaine's reaction to all this. He's just like, what the fuck? It's just great. Dylan and Dutch, they take out some more guards and they stop a helicopter from taking off. We have a shot of two guys on fire jumping into some water, as Matt mentioned earlier. And then we get the stick around line as Dutch impales a guard with a knife and then says knock knock as he completely takes out a wall. He also knocks down a woman who put a gun to his head. More on her in a bit. Duke says that if these guys were Central American, then he's a Chinaman. He says that the cabinet minister was CIA and the other guys they killed were Russian military advisors. This is when Dutch confronts Dylan in a scene that I never really got as a kid. And I gotta say, even as an adult, I'm like, okay, what are these guys yelling at each other about?
Well, he's upset that there was, you know, some key pertinent details left out. And it's a way to get around, this is getting around the superheroes don't kill, where he's like, your team doesn't do assassinations, but you still had to kill people on a rescue mission.
Man, all the times I've seen this, and even trying to take notes for this, I'm like, okay. I mean, you thought it was this person. Instead, it's this person. I don't know why Russian intelligence is okay. Hey, wrong person, wrong time. And we needed the badass guy to come save us.
Poncho says they have a half hour as there are gorillas 1 or 2 miles away, so they need to move. Dylan says that the girl has to go with them. And Dutch just says that she's your baggage. Ouch. He flat out called her baggage.
Thing is how Arnold started to respond to maids around that time.
Oh, geez. No, that wouldn't be for another decade or so. We're seeing more of the infrared vision, and Billy says that he wouldn't waste their only way out on a broke dick dog. What a line that is.
Oh, this whole movie is a I don't want to call it a relic, because the movie's not dated, though, in that
way
it's filmed. It's, from a modern action standpoint, it still holds up really well, but I say dated in the sense of the sensibilities. Mm-hmm. Like, in some of these lines, you can't say the F word now in anything.
No.
Or, you know, even like pussy jokes, that's kind of a big no-no.
Billy, the only thing I remembered him from was 48 Hours. And there's a story about this production in that they had
I love the story.
Yeah, I guess the guys went out to a bar when they all got hired to kind of get acquainted. And this guy, Billy, Sonny Langdon is his name, he gets in a fight, beats the fuck out of two dudes. And so the insurance company behind this movie said they could not hire him unless they hire a bodyguard, not to protect Sonny Langdon, but to protect people around Sonny Langdon. They say that in the I Ain't Got Time to Bleed documentary. I don't know if I believe it, but this guy apparently was a real hothead.
Yeah, well, you also know he was a porn actor.
Yeah, what a history this guy had. I do remember reading.
And that. Also, if you remember, he ran for governor of Kentucky because he saw Jesse and Arnold have success with that. But sadly, third time was not the charm for him.
I think it's funny, too, that it's like, hey, if you want him, you have to do this. In the production, you know, Joel Silver didn't say, never mind, we'll get somebody else. He went, okay, yeah, all right, I guess I'm going to pay for a bodyguard.
Well, you forgot one part of that impression.
What, the sniffing?
Yeah, the sound of snorting cocaine. Okay.
Yeah. Mac tells Dylan to turn around as he gets a scorpion off his shoulder. And then Hawkins just goes and tells Billy an Echo pussy joke, which actually breaks Billy up. But this is also establishing that you know, the Predator sees this and he actually impersonates this laugh later.
Great stuff. Yeah. Great stuff.
More infrared vision as the Predator continues to stalk, and we're even getting hints at his clicks and grunts. Again, a very slow unveiling of this title character and this, you know what? I didn't realize till I did research for this podcast, this is actually done by the guy who did Optimus Prime. Peter Cullen is here doing Peter the Cullen. Voice of the Predator, which blew my mind. I had no idea about that. We even get an infrared shot of his hand holding the scorpion. So again, slowly unveiling him. Meanwhile, the commandos, they continue roaming the forest, thinking that they're just going to be running into more insurgents as the theme picks up. Mac and Blaine, they start talking about how this forest reminds them of Cambodia. Complete bromance here. This was something that was kind of established organically. I did not expect a bromance between Duke and Blaine here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it also tells that this movie is also very good at establishing these guys have a history together. For sure. So it's natural that they'd have, like, you know, those kind of like bromances.
No, it's just, it all feels, there's a naturalism about it that just really is, can't be overlooked.
They've been trying to imitate this for so long. There's just no imitation for naturalism.
And I think it's when you put people together that all have that same achievement. They're trying to outdo one another, but It's in a friendly way. You know, you hear about Arnold fucking around with Jesse by telling the costume designer to lie about the size of their arms just to do a bet so that when they really measured it later, he could then, you know, shove it in his face and get a bottle of champagne. Just that kind of shit.
I love that Jesse Ventura is bragging about that on the documentary before it even happens. It's just so amazing. Dylan is having a hard time with Anna, telling her to stop sandbagging. Dutch asks Billy what is wrong with him, and he says that there is something in the forest, and says it might just be nothing. So are we to establish that Billy here has the shine? Like, is he psychically linked to this Predator?
He's the tracker.
I get that he's the tracker, but for some reason he's feeling the Predator's thoughts. It was really weird.
You know what? I'll say it because this movie's almost 40 years old. He's the magic engine.
Yeah, Ine Chuck.
Anna then makes a run for it. They chase her a bit until Hawkins grabs a hold of her, and we see the one time the effects in this movie kind of fail it as the see-through camouflage and the way this creature comes towards the camera. It's the only time I'm going to knock the effects, but it looks pretty bad.
Yeah, it's weird because I think it slows down and shakes, you know, so it's I won't say it's bad. It's just not as good as what happens later. Mm-hmm. And when I learned of how they created this effect and stuff, I'm really, really impressed that they filmed it in a certain color just to color code it out of the film to get that is genius. It really is.
And they filmed it over and over and over, which is why you get the blur.
Yeah. Amazing. Like it's fucking fantastic.
It's the one time where you can sort of see the seams, but in a movie this old, I will say in a comparison to the Terminator, it doesn't date as badly as that scene in the hotel where Arnold is like stitching himself together. They have that prosthetic on his face. So I'm not going to criticize it too hard, but I do love that the Predator, it's the one time he takes the easy way out. He takes the easiest competition out of the way first.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm going to pick off the easiest one and then work my way up from there.
But the effect gets the job done as Anna is just sprayed with blood. They find her covered in blood, and Pancho says that he can't tell if he found Hawkins or not, meaning he didn't know if it's his body. Dutch sees that the body is gone, and all Anna will say is that the jungle came alive and took him. Dylan thinks it's the insurgents from earlier, but Dutch questions why they didn't take his radio or weapon, and why didn't Anna just escape. They then put together that this is exactly what they did to Jim Hopper from earlier, so everything's just kind of coming together slowly but surely.
So what you're saying is they got to the hopper.
I didn't realize until I watched it for this podcast how many times they say chopper in this movie. If you took a shot every time they said chopper in this, you'd be dead.
Well, there's a whole reason why Austrian Death Machine put out a song called Get to the Chopper.
Yeah. We see a snake move down a tree as blood drips down, and then we follow it all the way up and see that the Predator has indeed hung Hawkins' body upside down. Another great reveal. Again, the direction here, just impeccable. We then see Blaine get taken out from behind as he's walking toward the camera and blood squirts forward. And
oh, by the way, like the gore work in this movie would make Tom Savini envious. Like, it's pretty great. Impressive. Like, he's freaking gutted in half.
Yes.
Yeah. And this one, I mean, you think that they're going to work their way down the list, maybe with people you don't know. So by taking out Blaine second, I think it's a smart choice. It could have been a timing thing, but it ramps up just the threat level really fast.
Yeah, he had a WrestleMania to commentate on. And this causes Mac to just open fire on the forest. And this scene would always make, Adam, you remember Omar, like it would make me and him just laugh constantly to watch this. What is he shooting at as he yells? Why is everybody else shooting at the forest? Like, it's just so funny.
Everybody just lines up.
Yes.
I don't know how they have any rounds left after this, because they keep refilling their mags and swapping them out. So they got no rounds left. They're fucking firing dry.
I guess that's the reason for this scene, is just have them run out of bullets so they have nothing else to really shoot at.
Yeah.
So the minigun runs out of ammo as Dutch and Dylan find Blaine's body. Max says that he doesn't know who did this, and Pancho says that there's not a trace of what was there before. Dutch tries getting Mac to hold it together by saying that Blaine was a good soldier, as Anna finds some of the Predator's blood on a leaf. So everything that the Predator leaves is being found by this chick hostage. We didn't get a moment of Mac paying his respects to Blaine. This was something that you didn't see too much in this. Like, they really take time to get Mac to pay tribute to his friend here.
Yeah, this is nice. I mean, it's not long, you know, what, 30 seconds, 50 seconds? And it's a good little, you know, for you, brother, and takes the swig, puts the flask in with him as he covers him back up. Simple character moment, but it gives you a little for both of them.
They once again try getting from Anna what exactly happened, and again she says the same thing, that the forest came alive and took him. We then cut to the Predator, and now that he's hurt, he has no choice but to completely show himself, and what a design this is. Incredible. And again, we already talked about Kevin Peter Hall in this role, but the reason why people are still making Predator movies is because of this design.
Without a doubt. And think about this, we're an hour into the film before we get this reveal. So almost two-thirds before we get it. And everything from just the fishnets around, obviously an alien type of skin, to the hands, to the dreadlocks, to the weaponry. It's humanoid, but alien. And this isn't it, that they hold off a piece until later in the film is also really smart and really cool. But it's this design. Sometimes you just nail it. And Stan Winston is important as anything in this film.
Mm-hmm. Because if this was not done correctly, people would have laughed with seeing the dreadlocks. Because remember, reggae music around this time was, you know, a thing. And that's kind of what your natural connotation is. So if this wasn't pulled off, the movie loses a lot of its impact, because you have to nail this if you're going to finally show the monster, because we've seen plenty of instances where you do this and they look like reject Buffy villains.
Yeah, if this was Jean-Claude Van Damme in a duck costume, I have a feeling that this wouldn't have the impact that it's had.
Rob Van Damme would have better choice than Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Well, he could have jumped further off the tree.
Love this cauterizing of the wound as he yells, and Anna seems to be the only one tuned into what they're dealing with, because she's the one who picks up the small clues that he's leaving behind, which was a nice touch because she can't really communicate with these guys. Max says nothing on this earth could have avoided or survived the rounds that he sent into the forest. Dutch then puts Mac on first watch. Pancho says there's nothing out there waiting for them, but it's actually Billy who says there's something out there, and it ain't no man, and that they're all going to die. Just a real
upbringing. Yeah, he's the hitchhiker from Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Exactly. Dutch says that whatever's out there killed Hopper, and now it wants them. More talk from Mac about Blaine as he speaks into the sky. He's then attacked by a pig. You heard that right. We have a creature come, which Mac is the one who kills it, and he's made fun of for it. But I like this because we're establishing that the Predator isn't the only creature in this forest.
Yeah, and this movie is also predicated on the nature of surprise. So for all we know, the Predator could have coerced this pig into running into them.
Mm-hmm.
In the midst of this, they lose Anna, but it doesn't take long to find her as she's scared out of her mind. They also see that Blaine's body is gone. Dutch questions Anna again, and she says that she doesn't know what she saw, but it was something that used the jungle to hide. Dutch then cuts her loose as she says it's blood that was on the leaves. And to this, Dutch says, if it bleeds, we can kill it. So many quotable lines in this fucking movie, my God.
No, I will say most of the one-liners don't feel as cartoony and comic-y as we get in other movies like The Running Man.
Oh, come on. Stick Around is completely cartoony.
Oh, Stick Around is.
Yeah, but the movie also leaves those in the first act when you're led to believe this is just another one of those type of films.
Of course. Dylan starts questioning their Boy Scout methods of setting up traps, and Dutch replies...
We're much smarter than that.
Dutch replies...
Always prepared.
Dutch replies, instead of complaining, maybe you should help. And McTiernan is just building the suspense as Mac breaks a shaver on his face and they're dead silent waiting for the trap to trip. Like this whole thing of him holding another thing I used to make fun of as a kid, this plastic razor. I mean, who hasn't held a razor up and tried doing this?
So I will say, because this was just one of the creepiest badass things that you see. There was something just really cool about it when you were a kid. I used to carry my disposable razors when I was in the service and made a point of dry shaving like this, just out and about. If for no other reason that Bill Duke did it.
Yeah, just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Exactly.
Oh, agreed.
As we talked about a couple series ago. Anna even gives an anecdote as McTiernan does a zoom focus on Dutch in the background, and Dylan responds, what are they going to try next, Swiss cheese? I love how Carl Weathers, this is 2 years removed from him being killed on Rocky. He does bring like an acting background here, but he's pretty much playing Apollo Creed, right, Matt?
Well, he's also playing, much like in Rocky, he's second fiddle.
Yes.
He is the sidekick.
Yeah, he wouldn't get first billed until the next year when he did Action Jackson.
Absolutely. And I love that bravado about him. He doesn't doubt himself, you know, and it's amazing to get someone that is going to stand nose to nose with Arnold and not feel inferior. And he doesn't.
I had just forgotten how much of a complaining bitch Dylan was in this movie.
Because he gets soft. He's not in the field anymore.
Yeah, yeah, good point.
Pushing too many pencils.
The creature is caught in the trap, but it cuts and shoots itself loose as it crawls around the tree and drops down. Another just astounding shot. You know, something about this is they tried using monkeys for this because they didn't want to get guys in these trees. So they put the monkey in the suit and it just did not respond well. It kind of protested as monkeys usually do. So they had to go to this route, and the effects, again, still work here. I love the way he curls this tree. Love it.
I like this. I think it also, if you don't pay attention, it doesn't really mean anything. But they set this trap and the trap worked. Like, they caught this thing. But also, he was sneaking up behind Arnold. That's where the trap was. So he was just sneaking up to fucking stake him and when they got it. So this is just a great little moment. And then, yeah, he goes ape shit. Though I gotta say, Arnold is the only one that like takes a laser blast to the chest and survives.
Yeah. You know, I didn't catch that. That he was actually going after Arnold when this had sprung.
Yeah.
It would have been a very different movie if that trap went off. Would have been Action Jackson versus the Predator.
We get that next week.
Yeah.
Oh, holy shit, dude.
I do like that Dylan is the one who spots this. He's the one who sees him go in the tree. So yeah. I did like that little touch as well. Dylan says he'll go after the creature if Dutch holds on to the choppa. And we see that Pancho is really busted up. In the midst of all this, Pancho gets stuck in a trap as well as this tree hits him. And God, did that look painful.
He gets hit with his friendly fire.
Yeah, right. We cut to Dylan and Mac running through the forest as Mac just stops, strips off some clothes, and says he's going to have him some fun. So he's just going absolutely crazy here. He's even saying lyrics from Mustang Sally as he's doing this. Just, Bill Duke is so good in this. I really like him in this movie. Dylan spots the creature and he goes, over here. As he walks, Mac pulls him in and points the creature out to him. Dylan says he sees it and he has a score to settle. Dylan then moves a bit forward as Mac gets underneath. He then sees the scope on the Predator's arm right before it shoots him in the head. Great splat of the red stuff here. Although, I like, again, this is a pretty bad nitpick, but the fact that he takes his head off and we see the head back on him later on, that kind of takes me out, but this is another great kill.
Agree on the fact that he still has a head, but if you forget that there's the entire splatter on the screen is just like Art the Clown goes, holy shit, that's a lot of blood. this is good stuff.
Anna, Billy, and Dutch, they make their way through the jungle. We cut to Dylan as he's looking for Mac. He spots his body and hears anytime as he spots it in the trees. The scope is turned on as Dylan's arm is shot off and he's yelling as the Predator finishes the job. Adam, what's a better death, this or the one in Rocky IV?
Well, either way, the arm's twitching the same way.
Yeah.
But the fact that, you know, Predator suddenly busts out like Wolverine claws. Fuck it.
Yeah,
like, this
right?
is every kit, we're getting a different version of the weapon. Like, we're getting escalation as we go. It's just really cool.
Well, this is better because he at least answered that he could have answered the 10 count.
I just love that this arm is shot off and he's still just screaming and shooting away. This causes Billy to completely lose it as he throws down his gun, takes off his shirt, and just carves his chest. And then he just turns to distract to slash his face as we hear him yell as well. Pancho is shot in the head and Anna is spared as Arnold fires away. And if you're doing your math, you're realizing that Anna is being spared. And this is when we realize, oh, she's not armed.
Mm-hmm. Just it nice was reveals. Dylan by the end.
Nice. Just some nice reveals here. Arnold yells for them to get to the chopper as he slides down a ravine and jumps right into the water. Gorgeous shot here, though. Between this and True Lies, I'll never not laugh when I spot Arnold and how his face looks when he's swimming underwater. Still, though, very fun shot here.
Beautiful shot, gorgeous pan out. You know, it looks really good.
So Dutch swims to the riverbank, pulling himself up through some mud as the predator plops down behind him. Dutch would seem to be screwed here, but he backs into a mud-built wall. And of course, after some shots that aren't even close, we realize that being covered in this mud means that Dutch cannot be seen.
I also love this reveal of the predator jumping down. And it's walking out of the water, just the slow-mo reveal of the camo coming off. And we get to just see that reveal again is top-notch.
Definitely. Still, though, Mythbusters fucked this up for me because...
Yes.
They came out and they did a test and they showed that mud does not get colder when it gets on your body. It gets warmer, so there's no way this would work. But fuck Mythbusters. This still works for me.
Yeah, it still works because here on out, the movie almost works as a silent film.
Yeah.
It's the most, like, we've gone from bombastic, excessive gun shooting to just, like, primal combat.
And for the last 15, 20 minutes, it's been a slasher film, right? He's taking one out after another, and here we have the quote-unquote final girl, who is actually Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, yeah. We got the woods. We got the lake. It's, uh-huh. I mean, put a hockey mask on him.
I love that we're also seeing the Predator's gadgets just kind of fizzle as they are now wet. That was a nice reveal. We also see Dutch formulate some sort of plan, and from here on out, it's mano a mano. We get the equip scene as Arnold is again setting up traps and the Predator is healing his wounds and propping his spinal cord trophy while preparing for battle. Great reveal there. So Arnold's pouring this gunpowder on a leaf. I like all the stuff, even though I could have done without the Arnold yell at the end. I don't know. Him yelling like a brontosaurus didn't really work for me.
It's in his creative control contract.
I don't know. His battle cry just didn't work.
Machismo yell. Definitely. It's, you know, we're about it's the third act go.
Dutch climbs up a tree and we see the Predator appear behind him, which is when Dutch switches trees. He then fires some Rambo-loaded arrows. I felt like this was a huge 80s thing, was these loaded arrows. And the battle is on. I really like this stuff as it's filmed beautifully, and the practicals add to it because it's all in the dark, though still clearly seen. And again, we're seeing the Predator's gadgets just don't handle being wet very well.
I know that this, I can't imagine how difficult this was to do. And the fact that they're actually out at a location makes it all. I know they built some trees, you know, for some of this. I get that. But to do this in the dark, but you could still see what's going on and you understand it, that Arnold's going to make these arrows that explode where Schwarzenegger had to have them as part of his arsenal in Rambo. You know, it's just, God, those two back and forth. It's good. And it comes down to mano a mano. And eventually it's just, fuck it, we're going to go hand to hand.
Yeah, I like that, you know, for the guy who was pigeonholed as, you know, the biggest action star, he actually, his character actually shows some intellect instead of, like, out-wrestling the Predator.
Predator jumps down and Arnold gets under a fallen tree trunk. God, I would hate to be in the mud for this long. Like, this is just, oh my God.
That's also when he's not really acting because, like, he's exhausted. They've been, this took a while to shoot. And Schwarzenegger's at his best a lot of times, not as an actor, but when he doesn't have to say a whole lot.
Yeah, In fact, there were stories from the set of him getting lines from the script and him looking at material and saying, no, I'm not going to say that. I'm only going to say this amount of words. I don't know if that's laziness or him just kind of knowing what his limitations are, but you're right. The limitations do work in its advantage here because you're right. It's from here on out, it's a silent film. The Predator starts firing off some rounds, which Dutch avoids. Dutch then follows the blood trail as Predator blood drips behind him. Dutch then sets off a fire trail before jumping in the water. This, of course, washes the mud off, so the Predator spots him and lifts him up. He goes face to face with him before lifting off his mask. And is this an Arnold Anakin Skywalker situation? He just wants to kind of look at him with his own eyes here. Like, what's going on here?
Either way, I don't care. You realize when he's first looking at him that, yeah, you got a lot of heat vision coming out your eyes, so the mud would never work. But this full reveal of the face, when you thought the monster was cool enough, this takes it up to that next level. God damn, that work. Just the crest of the head and then the mandibles, you know, that it looks. And yeah, you can make the joke about the pussy mouth and all that. I get it. But like watching the mandibles actually work and click and the sounds, this is why I loved this creature. It's imposing. It's amazing. It's fearful. This thing is, I fucking love this creature.
What's great about it, too, is if you're coming in for the first time and you're seeing this in theaters, you're thinking the helmet is actually his head. You have no idea that there's a face underneath that thing. So when he does take this off, and I like how the mask is taken off, like he has these air seals on it, and he's kind of pulling them off one by one. Just a great, great reveal.
I also like that they bring back the thing of it laughing at him.
Yeah.
This, of course, causes Dutch to say, "You're one ugly motherfucker." The Predator takes offense to this and just unloads on Dutch. I love this. He's just like, "Fuck you then," and he backhands him. He lets off some roars as he follows a crawling Dutch with his knife that grows from his arm, the Wolverine hand, as Adam called it earlier, and he has Dutch cornered. Dutch is daring the Predator to kill him, but he doesn't. He just walks away. Why? I think at this point, Dutch has lost it. Dutch is like, he is in complete war mode in that he's lost his mind. So this is why he's like yelling, "Come on, kill me, kill me." But the Predator walks away. Adam, why does he do this?
He sees the trap.
Oh, okay.
He sees, like, Arnold, you know, set it up where this was like the worst case, that if it, at least he could crawl into this little like burrow that he did, and he's got it set up. You know, if the Predator walks in, he's going to get hit with the tree, but instead he sees it. He realizes that those spikes are going to come down. So he's just like, "Huh, you a smart motherfucker," and jumps over it. And I love just the, "Oh shit," look on Arnold's face.
I think it's like, you know, acting out of desperation.
Dutch then sets off one of his traps, which has a rock flooring the creature. Dutch looks over at the fallen creature, and he has a rock raised to drop on him. But Dutch pauses and asks, "What the hell are you?" Which the Predator repeats right back to him. So they're both wondering what the other is.
Yeah, it makes no sense that the Predator would understand what that means. But for us as the audience, it's great.
Predator then opens up a device on his arm and starts laughing, this evil laugh that he took from Billy earlier. This tells Dutch that this is a borderline nuclear bomb, and Dutch makes a run for it as the bomb completely explodes. This, when you think about it, is very stupid. There's no way Dutch could outrun a nuclear bomb, but it's still fun.
Well, he could have done it if there was a refrigerator in that jungle.
Good point.
Okay, in 2025, I want to laugh that he's running away from it, but we were told to hide under our desks, so...
That's true.
I guess it holds. It's a low yield. It's Cambodian made.
We see a landing helicopter with Kevin Peter Hall at the controls. I like that John McTiernan gave him this little spot, as he's been covered by a mask this entire time, but he gave him a spot on camera.
Mm-hmm.
As we cut to Dutch emerging from the carnage covered in white, we see that Anna is already safe on the copter, as Dutch is just completely exhausted and out of it. We didn't see the helicopter fly off as the Alan Silvestri theme plays and everyone gets a sitcom-type close-up. This was odd.
Well, this is an 80s sitcom right here.
Like, I'm expecting the Growing Pains theme to be playing. We're seeing Carl Weathers catches a gun and smiles at the camera. And Billy smiles for the only time the entire... Like, this is just...
It's funny because I saw somebody put this closing credit to "Thank you for being a friend." And that's what I think of as soon as the credits start. "Thank you for being a friend."
Oh my god. Look, the Wild Bunch did this. So I get what McTiernan's going for, and I get that he wants these guys. We've seen these guys just get completely annihilated for 90 minutes, so I get what he's trying to go with here, but I just hated that 80s movies did this shit. Because we're seeing scenes that weren't even in the movie. Like, we're having Shane Black hold this comic book that wasn't in the movie, but that's when credits roll on Predator Boys. Oh boy, masculine film. Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Predator? Adam, go ahead, sir.
It's hard to discuss action movies without thinking of some of the ones that really set a standard and propelled the genre forward. And I feel like Predator not only stands on a Mount Rushmore of action films, but it kind of transitioned away from wartime jungle films that we were getting at the time into a new era. And Arnold was one of those that helped propel it forward. And I think this mixes those genres in a way that is hard to overstate just how well it is, because it's got the action, it's got the sci-fi, it's got horror elements, it's got witty dialogue. It has everything that you want that can't really be replicated today. Part of because it's fallen out of favor and half these lines would be canceled and you'd get protests and shit, and half because you just can't pull it off anymore. But for a second time, but I'm calling him a first time major director in John McTiernan, to have a star in Arnold Schwarzenegger who was calling the shots, to have so many personalities on set, you know, from Carl Weathers to Bill Duke to Jesse the Body Ventura, Sonny Landham having to have a freaking bodyguard for when they go out drinking it. This movie should have been an unmitigated disaster. And instead, it is one of the best if not the best action movies that exist. It's one of the best cross-genre movies that exists between sci-fi action, horror sci-fi action that is out there. It's a brisk hour and 47. And the amazing thing is, and I'm going to discuss it as we go on, if you want to have a fun day, why don't you go look at the running times of every Predator movie? And there's something creepy going on. But Alan Silvestri coming in to do the score, Silver just being at his freaking Silver best with this film. It is amazing just how 38 years later, I can watch this movie and I don't have to watch it, but I can still be enraptured by everything that happens. I can still have a fun time. I can still squeam at the Bill Duke's head getting blown off. And I can still be amazed at a creature that I have seen revealed dozens of times. This movie is an easy 9 on 10. It is as good as it gets for this type of genre. And it's amazing that they've not been able to come even close to this movie in the decades since. 9 on 10 for Predator. Anytime anybody wants to pop this movie on, I am down. Let's crack a beer and go.
All right, Goudreau, 9 out of 10 from Adam. Do you have a higher score, sir?
Well, I don't know if I can go much higher because that means I'd have to give it a 10. And I don't give those out. But a lot of the ones I've given out are to action movies. Aliens, The Road Warrior. So it'd be not out of my wheelhouse. But I can't go quite that high just because I don't put this on the same category as I do Aliens. Cultural significance, absolutely. But Aliens has a little bit more to it, but that's not a slight against this at all. I think this is a premier part of the Schwarzenegger pie as far as his best movies. And I think it's also one of the great examples of how a movie can lead you to think it's one thing and then weave its way through multiple genres without feeling like it's a jarring shift. And it's also one of the great salvage jobs in a lot of ways, because this could have been a movie that we'd be talking about if we did a whole section on just like cheesy B movies. This could have been like I Come in Peace with Dolph Lundgren, which I like a lot, but certainly not.
Me too.
Certainly not on the level of this. But
all in pieces.
So all in all, I think it's a lot of fun. It's just hard for me to call it one of the best action movies just because there's other ones I like better. But be that as it may, as an Arnold fan, this gives you everything you want. And it kind of lets him do some things towards the end that were different than what he was being asked to do. He doesn't have the cheesy one-liners at the end. He's not a one-man wrecking crew in this. He has to go against something that in a lot of ways has him outmaneuvered and outgunned, and kind of dumb luck gets him to survive at the end. So, you know, for a guy like that to show some vulnerability more so than he ever had at this point outside of Terminator because he was the villain. But this is a very strong 8 on 10 for me. It's easy watch, and anytime it's on TV, I'll sit and watch wherever it's at, no matter how far along it is.
All right, so an 8 from Goudreau. First of all, I have to say, if you are on this network listening to this show and you have not seen Predator, what the hell is wrong with you? That's number one. Number two, I'm more in line with Matt, and what I didn't realize until I watched it for this podcast with you boys, and this is why I love doing this show so much, is, yes, I've always known this was a great Arnold film in Arnold's pantheon of movies, but I didn't realize how good this movie was made. And in watching and looking at behind the scenes, reading behind the scenes, and then going through the film, in 3 years, Arnold Schwarzenegger had the 1-2 punch of Terminator and Predator, two movies that they are still trying to replicate the success of to this day. But what they don't realize is the horror elements of both is what made them what they were. And I love the fact that this team, McTiernan and his whole production team, Arnold himself, everybody was on board with that. This starts off as an action film, and as Matt brilliantly said, it reveals itself to be something else. And I find that to just be an astounding piece of filmmaking. And again, I don't think it's due to this script. I think it's due to the fact that you had a master at the helm here. And another thing McTiernan does so well, and we'll talk about this if we ever get to Die Hard, is establish geography. We know where these guys are at all times because of how McTiernan shoots this film. It is brilliantly made for an action film. Don't get me wrong, this is still a movie with Arnold facing off against an alien at the end. How ridiculous is that? It's pretty ridiculous. But the way this thing is made, the way this team is established, the way the camaraderie is established is astounding. So I'm going with an 8 as well. I can't go as high as a 9 or a 10 just because I think by doing that, I would reveal a passion behind this that I don't like bringing to these movies. It's a big reason why we'll never do E.T. I can never look at E.T. as a subjective piece of film because of how much it means to me. Predator is not that to me, but I can look at it. I can see a little bit of its flaws, which I've talked about throughout the course of this, but it is still a well-made film and I can pop this on any time. But I will say this when it comes to Predator. This is not a movie that I can sit down with my lover and say to Jen, let's watch Predator. This is not that type of movie. But when it comes to wedding time and I have a bunch of dudes at an Airbnb, which both you guys are going to be at, guess what? There is a slight chance that this movie could go on that night amongst a bunch of drinks. So that's what I'll say. It's the perfect man film. And so with that, I give this an 8 on 10. Just have a good time with this. Pop some popcorn, open a beer, watch Predator. You will have a good time. Will we have a good time next week? 3 years later, the brothers wrote another script, Predator 2. It's released. It's not with Arnold. It's with Danny Glover. So many things to talk about with this one. Oh my God. It doesn't get much more 80s and 90s action than Predator 2. Adam, what are you expecting when we talk Predator 2 next week?
I think this is one where we're going to be discussing how movies can change and how sequels don't always necessarily follow the same path as the movies that came before it. I think we're going to discuss how somebody's dad told their mother that they were going to see Three Men and a Little Lady and went to see Predator 2 instead. It's going to be interesting because I think genre bending is kind of what we get a little bit in this one. I think we get it in the next one. And I think we'll discuss a sequel that killed the franchise for a very long time.
Killed the franchise. Wow.
I mean, he's technically right because we didn't get another official Predator movie for, 20 years? My memory of it, I've only seen it twice, and one of them was for the retro we did back in 2018. So I'm curious to know if my thoughts have evolved because I used to hate it, but I sort of felt the same way about RoboCop 2 when we reviewed that all those years ago with Batch, and I've softened on it more so than I thought I would. So I'm curious to see if that will transition here.
I have a filmmaker friend I was working with in LA who defended this movie nonstop to me. So I definitely have stories that we'll talk about next week. And it's going to be quite the series here leading up to a review of Predator Badlands. But until next week, when we get to the second part, Predator 2, boys, we ain't got time to podcast. Thank you guys.
Why do you call it the Predator?
It's a nickname. You know, the data suggests that it tracks its prey, exploits weakness, seems to, enjoy it. Like a game.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Please do not touch anything.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
I'm sorry.
We're not dead yet.
What the hell are you?
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net. as we have tons of franchise reviews such as the Alien film series, Star Wars, Indiana Jones, the ongoing Marvel films, films of the DC universe featuring Superman and Batman, the Mission Impossible film series, the Jaws franchise, the Lethal Weapon films, the John Wick franchise, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, the Mad Max film series, Avatar, and so much more.
I wouldn't wish that on a broke dick dog.
Instead of complaining, maybe I should help.
Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
Do you think you could have found something bigger?
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
Hey, you know what? Fuck this. This is bullshit, man. I want a gun.
Scheduling done by Matt.
This shit's something. Makes Cambodia look like Kansas.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
What the fuck?
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
My men are not expendable.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
This stuff will make you a goddamn sexual tyrannosaurus, just like me.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2025, and any and all sound and audio clips are used for entertainment purposes only.
Billy! Billy! The other day, I was going down to my girlfriend. I said to her, "Jeez, you got a big pussy. Jeez, you got a big pussy." She said, "Why did you say that twice?" I said, "I didn't." See, it's because of the echo.
Hey, wrong person, wrong time, and we needed the badass guy to come save us.
We've already talked about the "ain't got time to bleed" line and the response to it, so I'll move on. But Dutch pauses and asks, "What the hell are you?" Which the
predator... I love that he replied.
Yeah,
go ahead. Sorry, go ahead. Good.
Which the predator repeats right back to him.
9 on 10 for Predator. Anytime anybody wants to pop this movie on, I am down. Let's crack a beer and go.
All right. Goudreau, 9 out of 10 from Adam. Do you have a higher score, sir? I guess Goudreau's away from the mic. I'll go ahead and go. Go ahead.
Fucker, the stupid mute button.
Okay, go ahead.
Sorry.
Well, I don't know if I can go much higher.
I definitely have stories that we'll talk about next week, and it's going to be quite the series here leading up to a review of the new Predator movie. What's it called? Predator Badlands? Is that the name of it?
Yep,
Lands.
Okay,
yep.
Leading up to a review of Predator Badlands.